Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent unraveling of Iraq as Shiite militias answer the call from their clerics to defend Baghdad and the holy shrines from the lightning advance of the ISIS insurgents, who have taken major cities in the north and are now on the outskirts of the capital. Dr. Nusaybah Yunus, an International Security Program Research Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins us to discuss her recent article at the New York Times, "The Army Alone Can't Save Iraq." And assuming that it's not too late, that military aid alone will not be enough to stem the tide of Sunni jihadists unless political grievances are dealt with by the Iraqi government that has alienated and marginalized Sunnis. And then we'll go to the UK to speak with Andrew Jennings, an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA, the organization behind the World Cup now underway in Brazil. He is the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences and is the author of Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging and Ticket Scandals, and his latest book, Omuerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Then finally, with the sudden influx of up to 50,000 unaccompanied minors, mostly from Central America, crossing the southern border so far this year, we will speak with Wendy Young, the executive director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. We will discuss what is behind the exodus of children from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico, and the humanitarian crisis it is causing. And joining us now from the UK is Dr. Nusaybah Yunus, who is an International Security Program Research Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her work focuses on contemporary Iraqi foreign policy, and she has previously worked on sectarianism in post-war Iraq politics. Her latest article at the New York Times is "The Army Alone Can't Save Iraq." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Nusaybah Yunus.
Thank you.
And I wish we were not talking about something so grim, but obviously the country of Iraq, as many have predicted for the longest time, could descend into civil war. And we are, I guess, at a very, very pivotal moment here. It seems that on the one hand, President Obama is using or leveraging the situation, the crisis, to try and get Maliki, the Prime Minister, to do what he should have done, or at least what the U.S. has been urging him to do for the last few years. At the same time, with this lightning advance from the ISIS jihadists, there may not be a lot of time. And with the call-up, of course, for Shiite militias, with their clerics sounding the alarm, a lot of analysts suggest that we are on the brink of sectarian war. So let's begin with the possibility of doing what you have argued for in your recent New York Times article.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel that President Obama has certainly accepted the premise of what I was arguing for. In his statement on Friday, he said that the problem in Iraq was not solely or even primarily a military challenge, and he's accepted the fact that Prime Minister Maliki's policies that have excluded Sunnis from political power for the last 2 years have played obviously a big part in creating the conditions for which ISIS, this radical militant group, has been able to take control of territory in Iraq. Of course, when you look at the background to what happened in the last civil war in Iraq, you had similar Islamist extremist groups who created a civil war in Iraq by violently attacking Shiite targets, but who took advantage of the wider Sunni community's despondency with the government. And the way in which that civil war was ended was by Sunni leaders taking charge of the fight against these Islamist extremists and bringing those territories back under government control. And what we saw in the years since that new political settlement was formed, which brought peace back to Iraq, is we've seen the gradual erosion of Sunni political rights and a new wave of Sunni dissatisfaction with the government, which expressed itself last year in waves of huge Sunni protests across the country. You had tens of thousands of Iraqis protesting non-violently for their civil rights, you know, for the right for Sunnis to not be thrown in jail without charge and not to be tortured in jail without there having been evidence of them being involved in any violent activity. And the government just simply failed to respond to that. And this has led to a real vulnerability in Sunni areas where Sunnis just aren't prepared to fight against these Islamist extremists, even though they don't agree with that philosophy. They're just not prepared to fight in order for Sunni areas to remain under government control. And this is an absolutely catastrophic development that could really lead to the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria becoming a territorial reality, which I think is what we're on the verge of seeing now.
And Dr. Nusseba Yunus, you mentioned the surge under General Petraeus that essentially hired the Sunni tribes to fight the Islamist radicals and essentially drive them out, although obviously that was not entirely successful, and how much they've been marginalized since. And the U.S., of course, has been urging Prime Minister Maliki to be more inclusive. What explains his obdurance? Is he sort of blind and boneheaded? I just don't understand it. I'm curious to know whether the Iranians, who obviously want stability next door, and they've obviously been in many ways the beneficiary of the U.S. intervention into Iraq, I imagine they also must be weighing in privately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's been a number of problems with the Prime Minister, and I think that a big part of his problem is that he's very, very keen on staying in power. I think that his sectarian agenda is very kind of overrated. I think it's much more about straightforward power play. In the 2010 parliamentary elections, Iraqiya, which is a political coalition that's dominated by Sunnis, actually won the elections. It performed slightly better than the Prime Minister's coalition, and the Prime Minister was absolutely shocked by this development. He had expected to win an overwhelming election, and he didn't. And in the aftermath of that election, I think kind of regardless of the sectarian side of it, he just set out to make sure that this political coalition could never again successfully challenge him in an election. He's been remarkably successful in doing that. He's challenged in turn every single one of those leaders. The problem is that those leaders happen to be the leaders of the Sunni community and their political representation. And I think what his actions have betrayed is the fact that the Prime Minister just fundamentally doesn't understand the way in which peace was reached in Iraq. He doesn't understand the fact that the last civil war only ended because Sunnis were prepared to take up arms on behalf of the government to rid their communities of these, you know, frankly, insane terrorists who are extremely dangerous. And, you know, he targeted their political leaders without realizing that this was the path to unraveling the political settlement that's brought peace to Iraq. And that's why we find ourselves now on the brink of another devastating civil war.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Nusseba Yunus, an International Security Program Research Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her work focuses on contemporary Iraqi foreign policy, and she has previously worked on sectarianism in post-war Iraqi politics. Her latest article at the New York Times is "The Army Alone Can't Save Iraq." So, how much, though, does corruption play a part? I've seen studies and estimates that say up to 80% of Iraq's budget disappears into corruption.
Yeah, I think it plays an absolutely enormous part, particularly in the way in which the Iraqi army is so incredibly institutionally weak. So what we saw with the storming of Mosul was the Iraqi army, which vastly outnumbers the Islamist insurgents who stormed Mosul, not just in terms of numbers, but also in terms of equipment and weaponry. There just should have not really been any contest. You know, the Iraqi army should have been capable of driving back this advance, but didn't even fight, didn't even put up a fight. They put down their weapons, which these insurgents then just claimed. They took off their uniforms and they fled. And that's because this army is based on one of the most corrupt systems in the world. You know, it's about making money for people. That's all it is. There's no morale. The institution is just rotten through and through. You know, people are on the books and paid salaries, and they don't show up, you know, and their commanders just simply take a cut of their salaries, not to say anything. And, you know, it's just a disease throughout the Iraqi institutions. And it's just, honestly, one of the biggest problems in Iraq, because it stands in the way of Iraqis not only building up an army that can successfully look after Iraq's security, but also from building up all the other institutions that Iraq needs to have a functioning modern state. And that Iraq should have, you know, Iraq is a middling income country. It has absolutely vast oil wealth, and the citizens just don't see that. The citizens live virtually in poverty with no public services and with just appalling standards of living, because all of this money is just squandered in corruption. And it's one of the huge grievances, actually, that was a center point of the protests that we saw in Iraq last year, and one of the few issues on which Sunni and Shiite Iraqis could unite in their dissatisfaction with the Iraqi government. And there was a real opportunity last year for a movement to start, you know, a civil society movement of Iraqis who are all dissatisfied with the performance of this government to revolt against the government. But unfortunately, it's too easy for leaders to play on the sectarian card, to divide Iraqis, and to basically shore up their own support, you know, as defenders of the sect, regardless of their pathetic performance in terms of governance.
And of course, at this point, the evidence is overwhelming that they have an existential threat from these fanatics, as you pointed out. And in fact, much of the coverage that I've seen of the fleeing families in the north into the safe area of Iraqi Kurdistan, they're all saying how much they despise the army and the police. It would seem, though, that in terms of what we hear in our press, that perhaps the definitions of ISIS, or as the president refers to it as ISIL, meaning the Levant, the way it's being described in our press as Islamists, they're as much Islamists as the Ku Klux Klan are Christians, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, ISIS their ideology is just one of the most extreme ideologies really in the world. And the vast majority of Iraqi Sunnis find it just totally antithetical to everything that they believe in. You know, we're not, it's important not to think of ISIS as the army of the Iraqi Sunnis, because it isn't that at all. You know, it's an opportunistic terrorist organization that's taking advantage of a vacuum of authority in Iraq's Sunni areas, and is taking advantage of the Sunni passivity. You know, the Iraqi Sunnis are allowing this to happen, though they don't support it, which I think is an absolutely huge mistake for them, and they're going to pay for that in the long term. And I think that what the Iraqi government, and the U.S. government in particular, what they need to do is to reach out to Iraq Sunnis and to the Iraqi Sunni leadership, and to persuade them that there is a future in Iraq that they can be a part of that's going to be something much, much more positive than ISIS could ever provide. And I think that the U.S. in particular does have, you know, I think that it would have some welcome, you know, some listening ears in the Iraqi community. I think whilst the Iraqi government has burned a lot of its bridges, you know, I think Iraq Sunnis saw what the success of the surge did for their communities, and I think would perhaps be prepared to fight against ISIS again if on the other side of that they were promised, you know, radical autonomy in a kind of federal territory in which they could govern themselves in an arrangement similar to that we see in Iraqi Kurdistan.
But who does the president speak to? Assuming this is his agenda, and it appears to be from what he said, he does have an aircraft carrier on the way. And, of course, he's getting a lot of Both the media and the Republicans seem to forget that the Iraq War was started by President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and he's getting slammed by both the press and the Republicans. So who does he talk to? Is Maliki listening? Is he available? I mean, Maliki didn't even get a quorum the last time the parliament opened. The impression is that they've fled as well.
Yeah, I think that President Obama needs to make it an absolute priority to talk to and to rally Iraq's Sunni leaders, starting with the Sunni politicians who are in parliament, but also reaching out to Iraqi tribal leaders that America has worked with before, and to try and get a sense of what they're feeling and thinking, and what would need to be done in order to signal strongly to Iraq's Sunni community that there is a future that is worth fighting for them. In terms of the Iraqi government, you know, we've just had a parliamentary election in Iraq, and the prime minister is now governing, you know, beyond his term. So we're at a very delicate time in Iraqi politics. The new government has not yet been formed. We're in a government formation phase. I think it's going to be extremely difficult to dislodge Prime Minister Maliki because we're now in a state of effective war, and in a time of war, you know, people rally around the leader, and it doesn't seem a time for political instability. But I think that by involving the leaders of Iraq's other Shiite parties and Iraqi Kurds, I think maybe the U.S. will be able to leverage enough pressure on Prime Minister Maliki to make some symbolic concessions to Iraq's Sunnis that will perhaps slightly turn the tide. But I have to say, you know, the real prospect of this being successful is looking pretty bleak.
Well, first of all, the Sunni tribal leaders are under the occupation of these fanatics. So that's a difficulty in itself. And the possibility that fanatics will do, after all, what stimulated the first civil war was the bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra, which is... I think the ISIS or ISIL have indicated they want to do that kind of thing. So we're in a very tenuous situation, right? It's more likely to turn worse than it is, you know, to get better, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the rallying of Shiite militias, and it's completely understandable that, you know, you have this radical extremist group that's threatening to murder Shiites and to destroy their holy sites. You know, of course, it's understandable that Shiites are rallying into militias to prepare to defend themselves and to defend their homes and defend their cities, especially since the Iraqi army has been shown to be as ineffective as it's been shown to be. But on the other hand, we're also seeing an enormous risk that innocent Sunni civilians are going to be massacred by these irregular forces who aren't trained, who aren't under anybody's control. And when that starts to happen, you get this, you know, it will escalate so quickly and so out of control that we're going to start to see scenes like we saw in the last civil war with 1,000 civilians being murdered every week and bodies lying in the streets showing signs of torture and mutilation. And nobody in Iraq wants the situation to get back to that stage except ISIS, because ISIS thrives in a setting of civil war. The more chaos and violence there is in Iraq, the greater the level of control that this terrorist group will be able to exert. And I think it's up to the Iraqi government and to the Shiite militias and to Shiite leaders to show as much restraint as they possibly can when it comes to Sunni civilians. Because by targeting Sunni civilians, you're only going to increase the amount of support that ISIS has and deepen this crisis even further.
Well, Dr. Nisaba Yunus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Nisaba Yunus, who's an International Security Program Research Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. Her work focuses on contemporary Iraqi foreign policy, and she has previously worked on sectarianism in post-war Iraqi politics. Her latest article at the New York Times is "The Army Alone Can't Save Iraq." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about FIFA as an organized crime family headed by its godfather, Sepp Blatter. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Jennings, who's an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandals. And his latest book is Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Jennings.
Lovely to be with you.
And Andrew, there's of course the IOC that you've also investigated, and I suppose to some extent Formula One racing. We have the daughter of Formula One's Sepp Blatter, who's bought the biggest mansion here in Los Angeles. So there's a bunch of examples of these organizations that seem to be incredibly self-serving in the name of sports. John Oliver, on his new show on HBO, did a takedown of FIFA. And one of the most amazing pieces that I recall from that was when Sepp Blatter very sort of smugly and sanctimoniously says, "Oh, we're a non-profit." The reporter says, "Yes, you're a non-profit with $1 billion in the bank." So let's start with $1 billion in the bank. What in God's name do they do with all this money?
You're not allowed to know. You're a human being. And I mean that very seriously. What Blatter has got away with over the years, and his predecessor, João Avalon, a Brazilian adventurer, is closing down what we call transparency. What you're used to in American public life, and we're used to now in Britain, is being able to find out how they spend the money, where it comes from. And in Blatter's world, he produces some very limited accounts, blessed by people he's very carefully chosen in Switzerland, who we've never heard of before, and that's that. And there's no way we can prize them out. Investigative journalists like me do obtain documents, as we do. But because they're covered by sports reporters, bless their hearts, whose skills lie in describing a game, that never are they told by their editors, go and get the documents or don't come back. Blatter gets away with his private world of what they do with the money. They spend a lot on themselves, and get this, we're not allowed to know what Sepp Blatter pays himself in salary, bonuses, all kinds of allowances. It's none of our business. It's private, because apparently suddenly the people's game for the Globe is his private business.
And of course, his reply to the reporter who said, you got $1 billion in the bank was, but that's our reserve. I think small countries on this planet don't have those kind of reserves, do they?
Well, that's their cover story. In case, imagine, and forbid this, that a tsunami sprung from the Atlantic Ocean and devastated the Brazilian cities with the stadia ready for the tournament had to be stopped. It couldn't happen. Then Blatter would claim they've got bills to pay. Actually, the Brazilian people pay the bills. And so this reserve is a bit of a joke. But again, if he says it's his reserve, too many reporters write it down and say, yeah, but what for? Is it for ordering your next crate of lobsters?
So, Andrew Jennings, then how has he gotten away with this for so long? And he has shaken down every country that's ever had the World Cup. But it's an even better racket than that, from what I can tell. You've got people literally throwing money at him for the privilege of having the World Cup.
Well, it's all part of the trick. You see, prime ministers and presidents think it in their interest to bring the World Cup and the Olympics, that's a similar story, to their country. And let me remind you, it's only about 2010, I think it was, that President Obama, it doesn't matter if it's Obama, the U.S. president entertained Sepp Blatter, the discreditable Jack Warner, in the Oval Office, and all the nice pictures were taken. I mean, you wouldn't let Jack Warner anywhere near your house. And now you know a bit more about Blatter, you probably wouldn't give him a visa. But you see, there's pressure from the football bodies. Oh, well, we've got to have the World Cup, otherwise America's nothing. I mean, if we don't stage the Football World Cup, people will think nothing of us. So that pressure is on all the time. And senior politicians don't say, well, that's too bad. You know, we've got other things going for America. We don't need the Football World Cup. But they give in to this kind of pressure from sports officials, believing that the fans demand it. When they don't, they like to buy new TVs and wash it with a can of beer in their hand. So there's a great lot of sort of just messiness around this whole thing again, created by sports reporters who all want the World Cup to come to their country so they don't have to do any work for a month or two.
So, but the Qatar bid, if that's the right term for it, seems to have blown the lid off a little bit, hasn't it? I mean, I've heard reports that the previous Australian government, who put up something like $45 billion in a failed bid, are going to ask for their money back because the bid was so clearly rigged. I mean, you had to be pretty naive not to know that the Qataris have the ability to up the ante.
Not naive, it's demanded. Yeah. If we look back over the history of awarding the World Cup, I can go back to when it was in Japan and Korea in 2002, and it became public knowledge, some honest people at FIFA saying, stop the gifts, I don't need any more computers, I don't need any more cameras, I don't need any more, go away. But nevertheless, it was very effective. Germany, a country that should stage the World Cup, nevertheless made sure they got it for 2006 by shoveling money under the table to five members of VASA's 24-man voting committee. And I know that because the money came from a German TV company. They went bust a bit afterwards, massively, and German reporters got hold of the liquidator's documents, got into his files and found the documentary evidence. I don't think Nelson Mandela paid for 2006. They all wanted their photographs taken with the great hero. But several other African competing countries did. Morocco did. Libya did. I think Tunisia threw a few dollars in the pot. So the boys got their money and their photographs with a very great man. Now, what's happening with Brazil? Well, that's a whole... It's wrong to think FIFA gave the World Cup to Brazil. Sepp Blatter, if you look at my book, Omerta, you see the criminality of Ricardo Teixeira, the boss of Brazilian football. The dubious Blatter gave the World Cup to the dubious Teixeira, and the poor old Brazilian taxpayers got to pay with it, pay the whole bill. Look at Qatar. It's not going to be in Qatar. It's not possible. And we may have to thank Fox Television for that, among others. It can't be in the summer of the Gulf. It's too hot. In the winter, you go and stand outside of the big football clubs in Western Europe, from Chelsea to Man United to Manchester City to Bayern Munich, and say, you're going to have to stop all your football for 2 months in the winter so that the World Cup can go to Qatar and our players can roast. And you'd be lucky if you're not trampled. And this is Blatter's problem. You let the boys play. You can guess how it got to Qatar. I'm not going to say it now, but we all know. But having given it to Qatar, something's going to be done to get it out again. This is, well, I don't think Blatter's going to last much longer. I think FIFA is going to fall apart over this scandal. But I can't see anybody going to Qatar.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Jennings, who's in the UK. He's an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences, and his books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandals, and his latest book is Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. But what I find extraordinary about FIFA's power and influence is, for example, in South Africa, they managed to set up a special court that had jurisdiction over what happened in the area that they control. They control all the vendors, etc. And they even put people in jail, a special kind of star chamber type of organization. And apparently in Brazil, where years ago they passed a law banning alcohol from stadiums because of some, incidents that had taken place, Sepp Blatter and FIFA have managed to basically force the Brazilians to allow them to sell beer because Budweiser is one of the sponsors. So this is an extraordinary power that they have. And then they also, of course, create, every time they show up for a World Cup, they create a tax haven for themselves in the country as well. So is this just in the same category of gullible politicians wanting to grandstand and being willing to sell their souls to the highest bidder?
It's a mixture of gullible politicians, as you say, and also crooks. Brazil has had a big, big corruption problem through the last military dictatorship, which ended in 1985, and that has continued. So there's a great deal of corruption in Brasilia Fortunately, there's also some very decent politicians, and I meet with them, and we do Brazilian hugs. We work together to try and curtail the criminality of FIFA. But a lot of politicians are bought up. It's like the reserves bench at the side of the pitch. They sit there waiting to be told how to vote. It's despicable that governments haven't got the guts to say, yeah, we like the sport here, and we'll put some money in, not all of it, because Brazil's put in all the money to build a stadium they don't need. That, of course, is another set of racketeering by football officials and politicians and the construction industry. And the people get screwed, and get screwed badly. Brazil may be a turning point. The politicians will feel brave enough to say, we'd love to see your game, love to see your football, but you are going to pay for a lot of it. We have enough stadium. That's why America should have won 2022. All you guys need to do is paint some new white lines on the grass of your stadia, and you're in business. You've got hotels, you've got airports, you've got everything. Just new white lines, okay? Just rub out the baseball and the what you call football, and you're in business. But because it's much more difficult to get American authorities to agree to the tax concessions, because you have so many levels of federal and state taxes, you're not going to win with the bunch of crooks that run FIFA at the moment.
Well, clearly there is, of course, an election going to take place in the fall in Brazil, and already this is a political issue. So presumably it's not going to go away. But one of the things that I found extraordinary about FIFA, and again, it goes back to this idea of what do they do with all this money that piles up, is that they made their own movie. Can you tell us a little bit about this? I've never seen the movie, but apparently it was an amazing piece of ridiculous vanity.
I couldn't put it better myself. It's cost about $30 million, which may not sound a lot for a big movie, but it's enough to make a movie. This was another massive blatter, waste of money and miscalculation. He really does, because he can get into the Oval Office, because he can get into the Kremlin. I'm embarrassed to say that he's been in 10 Downing Street, our Prime Minister's residence, a few times over the years. He really thinks he is the God King. It's time that a movie was made about him. And just to make sure he says all the right things, he'd have the blue pencil over the script. So FIFA have put out of money which should be buying football boots for kids in the developing world who play barefoot. They've put up the money for this ridiculous film. And apparently it was shown to three people at the Cannes Film Festival who all left before half time. And so it's never going to get in even in the art houses. And whether anybody is worth putting on DVD and looking for three people to buy it, it's another arrogant blatter, just diverting the money of the game. I think his plan was everybody will go, wow, he's even more important than we thought he was. Well, that didn't count for the disclosures that have come in the last few weeks with London Sunday Times showing or getting hold of something like a million emails and pieces of paper with interesting sums of money on them. Mm. So not only was it an obscene waste of money which should go to sports development, but you've got to admit you've seen it after the recent disclosures. It's going to be, no, I was too busy. I couldn't get out of the cinema, and I haven't got a DVD player, and leave me alone, please. Because Blatter's on his way out. We have to make sure that happens. And we have to ask the sponsors, most of whom are big American companies, can you just stand up and do a bit of this? They talk about corporate social responsibility, don't they? And big companies have departments designed to carry, to handle corporate social responsibility. And what have we got from, in any order, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Visa, abroad, Samsung, there's about six of these big companies, Adidas. They put out statements recently, very similar to the ones they put out in 2010, when me at BBC Panorama and our good friends at Sometimes Insight, we had a crack doing disclosure stories over a few weeks in late 2010, and so the sponsors trot out this, well, we know, we require that FIFA investigates. Who's investigating? Blatter has hired his own investigator, a New York lawyer who was a U.S. attorney, but he ain't now. he's hired a private practice lawyer. Wouldn't John Gotti like to have nominated, oh, I think he looks pretty stupid, I'll have him to investigate me, and I'll edit the report, and you can all go away. That's what's happening now. But you see, Coca-Cola's nervous. If they sort of really get so troublesome, they fear that another fizzy drink company could take over. You've got two major credit card companies, and Visa are always looking over their shoulder at MasterCard, who got forced out in very corrupt circumstances a few years ago, and that ended up in the Manhattan courts. Blatter paid $90 million to get rid of MasterCard, having lied to them extensively. So these are actually shambolic lowlives, and you'd like to think that the big corporations would live up to their claim of corporate social responsibility. Just get together, issue a statement, saying if Blatter's in power next year, we hope that you can find a mango juice company to fund you. That would frighten off Pepsi and the others. Who wants to step in and say, we don't mind if they're corrupt. We just want to sell corrupt colas. It would work. But they haven't got the proverbial lumps of flesh they need to do it.
Well, it seems, though, Andrew Jennings, that FIFA has its own ethics investigation. And for reasons I do not understand, they're going after Franz Beckenbauer, the German soccer legend. So what's going on there? They banned him for 90 days. Is he some kind of fall guy? What's going on?
It's a diversion. You know, when politicians are in trouble, they'll try and get you to look in a different direction. Look over there, there's somebody doing something really wrong. Stop looking at me and my crimes, my thieving. And this is it. Beckenbauer, and I actually agree with him. I know other things about Beckenbauer that have nothing to do with this. Beckenbauer said, I'm not meeting this lot. He could smell, as I could, that this ethics investigation is a joke, it's unreliable, it's unacceptable, and they're not going to publish the results. I keep reading, they're going to read the FIFA ethics code. It is not. Read my book, Omerta, do a chapter on the last ethics investigation about Blatter being involved in handling a $1 million bribe. They won't publish the result. We have to believe he was cleared by his own investigator. So the thing with Franz Beckenbauer, a great footballer, great player, great manager, won the World Cup twice for Germany. To ban him means you get all these headlines about Beckenbauer, and they're not about Blatter. Oh, thank goodness for that. Oh, good, it takes a bit of pressure off when everybody starts talking and not knowing what the Beckenbauer thing is about. It's an absolute nothing. But it takes attention away from questions like, Herr Blatter, didn't you know about those millions of dollars going to all those delegates at your Congress who last week raised their hands and said, you're wonderful, we want to re-elect you? Could they be connected with the millions of dollars they got from Qatar? We asked the question, Herr Blatter, and he's gone. This is why I'm banned from his press conferences, because I ask those kind of questions like any reporter would ask of dubious politicians. I'm no different in that respect.
So, Andrew Jennings, in the broader sense, though, obviously an enormous amount of corruption took place for the Winter Olympics in Sochi, estimated $30 billion worth of corruption. But that's in the context of Putin's Russia and, this kind of KGB-regulated kleptocracy that goes on there. But in terms of football itself, the world's 20 richest football clubs made $7.4 billion in the 2012-2013 season. And we know that all kinds of plutocrats and billionaires are stepping over each other to buy teams, whether they're Russian oligarchs or American businessmen. So already it seems that the sport, if that's too kind a description, is awash with money.
Certain levels, two clubs in Spain, two clubs in Germany, one club in France, about four or five clubs in England, the rest of the leagues and the rest of the clubs are staggering to keep going under the costs that they have to meet. There's certainly no plutocrats there. And of course, for these rich foreigners, I think with the exception of the Glazers, who I think came in, saw a business to make money, let's be fair to them. We don't like it in England that the Americans bought one of our clubs, but nobody's accused them of impropriety. When you look at the oligarchs and some of the people from the Gulf, they're trying to buy respectability. And if you can get respectability in the sports pages, it tends to spread. And the rest of the paper read, oh, they seem all right. They're getting good reports in the sports pages. Maybe they're not a bunch of crooks. We'll stay away. But it's not going to last because The Qatar thing is just going to collapse. Let's be very clear. It's not about Arabs. It's not about Muslims. It's about climate. And nobody in the game wants to go to Qatar. And if you are one of these rich oligarchs that owns a European club, do you want your players? Maybe you spent $50 million on one of them. Do you want him to go and get heat stroke?
Right. Well, it's 120 degrees, right? I mean, are they going to build air-conditioned stadiums? I mean, what?
Well, they are. They claim they are. Yes, you know, I intend to fly to the moon next week just flapping my arms.
Right.
the problem with the Qatar thing is they wanted it. It's this whole soft power. They're very nervous about being a very small, vastly rich country which could be overrun anywhere from Saudi to Iran, the big powerful neighbours near them. And in order to try and get themselves a better image when they're not allowing Nepalese labourers, and that's, you know, the other issue, so the people building these stadia are poor, poor labourers from Nepal, and they die at a rate which just is just outrageous.
Well, it's modern-day slavery. If they have no rights, they have...
Exactly. Yeah. It's exactly that. And we should all be saying to Qatar, yeah, well, we can't invade you to stop you doing slavery, but we can ignore you. Go home. Ambassador, just go home, will you? There's a smell around your residency. It's dead Nepalese labourers. But I think just maybe as a final thought, look at how Qatar got it. The IOC and FIFA have always done one big event at a time because you've no idea what's happening more than 7 years ahead. You don't know what television rights, marketing rights, anything is worth. Suddenly, the old boys at FIFA decided to run 2018 and 2022 together, knowing that the two contenders for the two big prizes were both undemocratic, petrol dollar, no auditors, no accountants, and the KGB to help out where necessary. We can't prove that money by the barrow load, the ship load, went to a dozen old men at FIFA. But everybody thinks so. Everybody looks at it because the FIFA's technical report said we can't go to Qatar. Sorry, it's the climate. Not the residents, the climate. And they voted for it. They took their money, so we think, and walked away. And they, well, they're still in charge of FIFA, actually. They're still there. And now the rest of football has to sort out this problem. And all this messing about with, well, maybe we could have it in the winter. Who cares if all the leagues have to stop? Here's something which you might pick up in America. One of your big media people, of course, is Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch's Sky company in Britain owns the rights to our Premier League, which is probably the best league in the world because it's got the money, thanks Rupert, to buy the best players in the world. Now, who's volunteering to go and knock on the door? Hello, hello, Mr. Murdoch, can I come in here, please? What do you want? There's not going to be any football for 2 months in the winter. You're just going to have to take your cameras home. They're closing down all football, and there'll be no income for your company. Is that all right? Ouch.
Not going to happen. Well, Andrew, Andrew, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I very much appreciate the conversation and the enormous amount of work you've done exposing this incredibly rotten organization that's been shaking people down for decades. And there's just something awful about these smug, sanctimonious Swiss plutocrats. I mean, what would you describe them in the last few seconds here?
FIFA, an unregulated racketeering organization.
Well, again, Andrew Jennings is an investigative reporter, best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging and Ticket Scandal. And his latest book is El Muerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Thanks again, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the sudden influx of up to 50,000 unaccompanied minors into the United States.
Boy, head head against a pillow fast asleep. Poor girl, head against a window lost in dream. But one day they will be as giant, stronger than the sun. But that day ain't yet come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wendy Young, who's the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions in the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Young.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program.
And this extraordinary influx of up to 50,000 unaccompanied minors into the United States, mostly from Central America, it probably by the end of the year will reach, what, 90,000, do you think?
Yeah, the estimates keep rising, but I think it's fair to say we may be facing 80 to 90,000 or even more. And the projections for fiscal year 2015 are 127,000. So the numbers are clearly on the rise.
And what's causing this exodus, do you think?
This is really a humanitarian crisis, which President Obama said himself last week, rightly so. And it's really more of a refugee-like movement than it is a migration movement. These kids are really fleeing violence in their home countries in Central America, with the top sending countries being Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
And what's driving them out of these countries?
It's violence created by gangs and other criminal rings. More and more, these gangs are preying upon children at much younger ages. They're literally going into schools to recruit kids, threatening their lives or threatening the lives of their family members. So families and children are making the desperate decision to send their children across international borders in search of protection. It's also important to realize this is a regional crisis. It's not just a U.S. crisis. Kids are also fleeing into Costa Rica, Panama, and other countries in the region, as well as the United States.
But my understanding is that the exodus from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, obviously through Mexico, is incredibly hazardous. And these children are preyed upon all the way, and it's a miracle they even get to the United States.
Yeah, which really underscores their desperation and their need to get out of their home country, because the trip is incredibly dangerous. We see kids who are robbed, beaten, murdered, and particularly high rates of sexual violence against girls as they come. More and more of the girls that we are serving through KIND are arriving pregnant as a result.
So, but the violence in these countries and the gangs, aren't gangs largely organized around drug dealing?
It's all interconnected. It's gang violence, it's narco trafficking, it's the same cartels that are engaging in human smuggling and human trafficking. Basically, this is about business, a very evil form of business, but these are people who are making a lot of money off of very vulnerable children.
So in other words, the same cartels that distribute the drugs into the United States are the same cartels that run the coyote networks?
That's exactly right, and they're manipulating the situation to draw more and more children into the movement, so that's why you see that the numbers are on the rise. It's a combination of violence and kids being manipulated into moving and being taken advantage of as they migrate across the region.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendy Young, the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. So it seemed to me, Wendy Young, that given that these children arrive, those that survive this hazardous journey through Mexico into the United States are in immigration detention. I guess if they have family here, they're released, and most of them don't. But doesn't the U.S. in effect bear a responsibility here because of the American appetite for drugs? If we're the market for drugs, which we clearly are, and that market destabilizes countries through which drugs flow from Colombia and other countries that produce particularly cocaine and heroin. If this this violence and these street gangs, like in El Salvador, the MS-13, are huge drug dealing organizations as well, don't we have a moral responsibility here for in effect destabilizing these countries?
I would say we both have a moral obligation and also a national self-interest in addressing the crime that's occurring in those countries. And it's also true that we have a moral and legal obligation to sort out the children who do arrive in the United States and determine who needs protection and who can safely return home. That can be done both under our asylum or refugee laws, as well as other forms of protection available under immigration law to these children. These kids need our help when they arrive here. That's just the bottom line, most fundamental point. And to do that, we really need to provide them with appropriate care. We need to provide them with legal counsel to help them through their proceedings. And we need to provide them with an opportunity to remain here if they truly do need protection, and to help them get home if they don't.
So tell me, Wendy Young, what your organization does on a daily basis when you are confronted. I saw a picture. It looked like a sort of surreptitiously taken picture of a huge detention center, I think in Arizona, an immigration detention center, where it was like a warehouse full of young kids.
That's correct. What we do at Kids in Need of Defense is we partner with the private sector. We have partnerships with over 210 major law firms, corporations, and law schools to provide pro bono or volunteer legal representation to the children in their deportation proceedings. It's important to know that when the kids arrive in the United States, they are immediately placed into deportation proceedings where they must raise a defense against their removal from the United States. That's an extraordinarily hard thing to do. It's done in a formal courtroom setting before an immigration judge, while a trial attorney from the Department of Homeland Security is arguing for the child's removal from the country. And there's the child standing alone in a courtroom, expected to raise a defense against removal. I've been in courtrooms and seen children as young as 5 years old stand there without a lawyer.
Well, that's heartbreaking. I mean, what's your sense then of getting some sort of national attention here? Because the coverage is mostly, I've seen coverage that's talking about billboards up in Central America encouraging people to come to the United States as though this is some kind of, you know, El Dorado, when in fact this is all done in desperation, and it is a humanitarian crisis.
That's correct, and it really requires a two-pronged approach. First and foremost is to ensure that we do provide protection to those children who need it. And secondly is to try and control this migration flow by cracking down on those gangs and narco traffickers and cartels that are preying on the children. That's a difficult balance, but we have to avoid re-victimizing the children and ensure that we really do provide the protection to those that need it.
And what are you lobbying? Who are you lobbying, I guess, in this case?
We're talking to both the administration and Congress to work with them to see if we can find solutions that really address this problem at its core. This isn't an easy situation, and I do think that the administration did the right thing when they opened the emergency shelters, because first and foremost, they had to put a roof over these kids' heads. But it's time to move beyond that and really seek comprehensive solutions that address the full spectrum of the problem.
But given that emigration is a sort of almost a taboo subject now, particularly after the defeat of Eric Cantor, although I think much of the press misread that campaign, the insurgent candidate who won wasn't so much beating up on Cantor for support of emigration reform, but arguing that Cantor's, because of his Wall Street connections, was mostly interested in bringing in sort of cheap labor for corporate America. That was mostly his platform. But as you know, as a result of this upset victory, the pundits are declaring immigration reform dead on Capitol Hill.
Well, certainly, you know, we have very deep systemic problems in our immigration system that are just crying out to be fixed. And we are in support of doing comprehensive immigration reform. But I have to say the situation with the children currently is very different. It has nothing to do with comprehensive immigration reform. Some have tried to posit that the prospect of reform is drawing these children to the United States. And our work, as well as the work of many other organizations, including the UN Refugee Agency, have found that no, it's really the push factor of violence. So we need to treat this as a refugee situation first and foremost, not as an immigration matter.
And as a drug matter, I mean, how much do we spend on the DEA? It's an enormous amount of money on this war on drugs.
Exactly. And again, there's good reason to address the root causes. Most people around the world want to stay home. They do not want to migrate. And we need to provide these children and their families viable, safe opportunities to remain home. And the only way we can do that is by exercising our foreign policy and our international development programs in a way that supports them and creates safety in the home country so that people don't feel compelled to leave.
So these children who make it through this grueling trip where they're preyed upon by gangs and robbers and rapists all the way to the United States, and then they make this illegal crossing and then go through the deserts, usually of Arizona and Texas. There have been many indications that a lot of people have died in the Southern American deserts as a result of coming here and essentially not knowing where to go. I mean, the coyotes usually just abandon them at the border. They take their money and just leave them up to their own devices. If you're a 5-year-old child, what chance do you have in the southern desert?
Oh, it is an incredibly dangerous voyage, and I don't even know how many of these kids may be dying along the way. And then, you know, when they arrive, they're also detained by the U.S. government and, again, placed into deportation proceedings. So the challenges don't stop at the border. And I think this really does underscore, again, the desperation that they're feeling to begin with to try and make that very, very difficult voyage by themselves. And I have colleagues who've been down at the border recently and literally seen 4-year-olds walk across the border alone.
So just in closing, Wendy Young, what kind of our listeners who are concerned about this humanitarian crisis and these vulnerable children, how do they contact your organization?
Sure. Our website is www.supportkind.org. We also welcome phone calls at 202-824-8685.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Wendy Young.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendy Young, who's Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.